Revolutions Per Minute is a weekly radio show from the New York City chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America, recorded live at WBAI 99.5 in Brooklyn every Tuesday at 5. RPM is about doing the work to build a democratic socialist future. Every week, hear the latest news, analysis, and organizing experience from the minds and hearts of activists fighting every day in NYC. Join the movement at socialists.nyc.
Yo, what's good, New York? You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute on WBAI 99.5 FM. We're a socialist radio show and podcast for members of the New York City Democratic Socialists of America. NYCDSA is the biggest chapter of the largest socialist organization in the United States. We are run by our 5,500-plus members and organizers who are working together to build democratic socialism in all five boroughs. Today, we're covering the struggle for justice in Palestine with Danielle Lightfoot and Eric Sturm from DSA, and later with Shana Lowe for the Defense for Children International. More specifically, they're joining us to discuss DSA Anti-War Working Group work alongside Defense for Children International Palestine on the No Way to Treat a Child campaign. The campaign seeks to pass congressional legislation ending U.S. funding for Israeli military detention and torture of Palestinian kids. But first, the headlines.
Hey, New York City, this is Kyle Sorrell with the headlines. In city news, City Council member Costa Constantinides introduced a bill that would ensure that solar panels are built on Rikers Island when the jail is closed, preventing luxury real estate developers from taking over. A town hall was held on renewable Rikers Island last week with Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. AOC gave this impromptu speech to people who couldn't get into the packed town hall.
Conducted a study, she saw that if you just put 25% of Rikers, just 25% of Rikers Island and cover it in solar panels, we can close every toxic power plant in New York City that was built in the last two decades. Woo! And we have to always show, and we always have to always realize that these injustices aren't abstract, right? The clean air, our right to clean air and our right and our access to clean water always falls along lines of income, falls along lines of privilege. And so what we need to make sure is that no child is getting subjected to asthma because of the family that they were born in and the zip code that they were born in. That no person should get lead in their water because they couldn't afford to live in a high-rise apartment. Right. These are not luxuries, these are rights.
Governor Cuomo endorsed Melinda Katz for Queens DA and is preparing to fundraise for her, calling on the corrupt developer dollars to try to stop Tiffany Caban's grassroots campaign. Bronx Borough President Ruben Diaz Jr. is preparing a pro-real estate and pro-development campaign for mayor of New York City in 2021. As a result of a constitutional challenge brought by activists and the Legal Aid Society, the NYPD has amended its patrol guide to prohibit officers from profiling trans people for a prostitution-related loitering misdemeanor. In state news, the Climate and Community Protection Act, which would transition New York to 100% renewable energy by 2050, has a majority of sponsors in the State Assembly and Senate, but it is still unclear if it will be voted on due to Cuomo's opposition. Cuomo and State Democratic Party Chair Jay Jacobs are attempting to kill the green light bill by warning Long Island Democratic state senators of an anti-immigration backlash that could cost them in future elections. The green light bill would allow undocumented immigrants to receive driver's licenses, which is a crucial document to lead a normal life in New York City. Environmental regulators in New Jersey joined their counterparts in New York by rejecting a bid to build a natural gas pipeline across New York Harbor. Environmental groups hailed the decision, but pipeline operator Williams Transco has indicated it will reapply in both states. The Williams fracked gas pipeline is back, just 2 days after New York State denied construction permits for the dangerous pipeline the company reapplied. New Yorkers have until Thursday, June 13th at 5 p.m. to submit public comments on the pipeline, which would bring fracked gas from Pennsylvania into New York City. More information on submitting a comment can be found at www.stopthepipeline.org. June is a huge month in New York, so stay tuned. Back to you, Jack.
Thanks, Kyle, for a great reading of the headlines. Kyle is very busy working on the Tiffany Caban campaign out in Queens, so please help him out if you have the chance. Our daily headlines are brought to you by The Thorn, an incredible weekly newsletter by NYC DSA Electoral Working Group covering local politics and radical activism. Subscribe at thethorn.nyc. All right, so I guess before diving in, I just have to reintroduce myself to the listeners who haven't been listening before. I'm Jack Devine, he, him. I'm a member of NYC DSA, and I've been working on this radio show and podcast for nearly half a year now. So today we are talking about the struggle for justice in Palestine. And we have three people with us. We're going to start out with Danielle and Eric. So, Danielle, why did you get involved in DSA, and why did you join DSA Anti-War specifically?
Well, I got involved in DSA for a number of reasons. The first thing was DSA support for the Bernie Sanders campaign, which I was aware of in 2016. Another thing was DSA's activism on behalf of the Yemen War Powers Resolution in Congress to end U.S. involvement in the Saudi-UAE war, and in particular, the direct action, the different organizing, grassroots organizing around the bill that was being done in NYC, including by the Anti-War Working Group, and as well DSA's passage of the BDS resolution in 2017, indicating DSA's support for that. I was very concerned about the Palestinian issue and the U.S. support for Israeli violations of Palestinian rights all my life, because my mom actually was a refugee from South Lebanon during the Israeli intervention in the Lebanese Civil War and subsequent occupation. So,
and Eric, what about you?
Some of the same reasons that Danielle mentioned. Also, I was a bit involved with some of the canvassing for Julia Salazar, and I was, I think, really inspired by, I think, DSA's strength in trying to reach, everyday people on the street, door knocking, just kind of talking to everyday people about issues that matter to them, specifically, working class issues. So that was pretty important to me. I've been involved in some other organizations like If Not Now that I think we're really working within the Jewish community specifically. And I wanted to kind of have my work reach, I think, just like a broader base of all Americans. And I think that's really what socialists should be doing, right? We're trying to reach something that universally reaches everybody, that makes the world better for all people. So I think I really wanted to be in an organization like that. DSA seemed like that kind of place. And then Anti-War Working Group specifically, I think the fact that they signed on to BDS, and I think there was capacity there to use kind of the electoral work that we do, a lot of the grassroots connections that we have, and also to build those up. I mean, there's I think a lot of capacity for growth. I think we're seeing that within the electoral work, and I think that same capacity for growth can be extended to anti-war work.
Yeah, I think you both touched on this theme where there are a lot of different reasons that people get pulled into DSA, but they feel grounded in, one, the work that is actually going on, whether it's the canvassing that you're mentioning for Salazar, or getting involved in the Bernie 2016 campaign, or it's not just siloed off into these electoral issues. Anti-imperialism is a really critical front of struggle for socialism, obviously as a principled struggle, but also it really draws in people who have particular experiences of oppression from these forms of colonial violence. So why should people care about the struggle for justice in Palestine? How does it affect them? This is both a moral question, but I think it also, because of socialist analysis, reaches beyond that. So either of you want to give that a go?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the reasons that we should care as Americans is that the U.S. has been playing a crucial role really for the better part of the last 50 years in the Israeli occupation of Palestine and the other violations, that arise from that, which some of which we'll get into in detail later. And I think specifically the U.S. military aid going to Israel, it's by far and away the most military aid to any country. And you're talking about a country that is itself producing nuclear weapons, that is an arms exporter. So there's even questions of why are we even giving them military aid to mm-hmm. begin with, even beside, you know, the violations. And I think it's also when you get into just not just Israel, but in general, the military budget and U.S. arms sales, there's a question, you know, of what we could be spending that money on instead, not to dismiss the substance of the violations of Palestinian rights, which many of them are quite sadistic, you know, and deserve their own not to be supported in their own right. But mm-hmm. do you think of things like Medicare for All that we could be supporting, or with the funds that are going not just to, you know, Israeli military aid, but the military budget in general, free college for all, you know, public college, a Green New Deal, you know? So I think it ties into other issues in that regard as well.
Right. I pretty much agree with that analysis. And when you think about, I think, $3.8 billion a year going to the Israeli government, you have to think, okay, what's the Israeli government doing? And when you see this expansion of settlements, right, like people are being killed in massacres in Gaza, when this is how the money is being used, I think the reasonable question is, you know, why are we continuing to allow this? You know, if we have some type of democratic process, we can try to, you know, influence our government, influence how our tax money is spent, shouldn't be going to this. And so I think that's kind of on a, you know, we want money going towards things that benefit us. And then also we don't want our money being used to, you know, kill people around the world and, you know, harm people, detain, you know, innocent people. So I think there's, you know, people often say like, oh, well, you know, it's hard to get people to, you know, think about like anti-war things because it's not really like self-interest. It's like, oh, it's people over there. How do we get people to care about that? There's an element of truth to that because I think people have to realize, okay, this isn't affecting me in my, you know, in my backyard. This is affecting people. Maybe I don't know them so well, but I think the principles are like, we don't want to, you know, support these kind of things, but there is a direct relationship to, you know, this is money. There's only so much money we are spending. We either increase taxes on the rich, which we should do, but we also need to, you know, the money that we are, you know, collecting, how are we using it?
Yeah, I think the question of resource allocation is definitely at the center of this. And I think the relationship between the U.S. state and the Israeli state is emblematic of the way that resources are distributed in our society, mm-hmm. and that the focus is on generating more and more wealth and power for the already empowered forces in our society. Like in the United States, the military-industrial complex benefits immensely from the relationship with the Israeli state. But in that relationship and that power center of the military-industrial complex means that resources, both from, you know, the government's budget, but also in general in our society, the way that things are structured, the way that private capital has so much power, is that it pulls more and more resources into their sphere and also shapes the way that, you know, our university system allocates its resources so that more research is done for militaristic aims rather mm-hmm. than developing technologies that have a positive use for the billions of people around the world rather than the capitalist imperialist ruling class. So I think, you know, and there's so many ways that this is a critical front for socialists to struggle. And obviously it's a moral question about, you know, the horrors that Palestinians are facing on a day-to-day basis. And we should oppose that for that reason in of itself.
Right.
But it's also about the way that power is structured and organized and how this relationship is critical to the U.S. empire's domination of the world. So is there anything that either of you would like to add to why this is such a critical front for socialists? And if not, I'm happy to move on to like a, you know, we can't give a deep historical analysis of the situation there. But like, how did the Israeli state come to violently dominate the Palestinian population? And can you give like a brief overview of how we got to this point and the role of the U.S. in that? I know I just asked a lot of questions and we can break it down one by one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, you know, there's the shortest way you can break it down is, you know, going back to 1948 when Israel was founded. You talk about the expulsion of the Palestinian refugees. I mean, that is still one of the outstanding issues today that the BDS movement and Palestinians broadly, even the government officially, the official line is that's a concern. And the U.S. has been, ever since it's been, you know, the lead benefactor of Israel for the last 50 years, has been adamant that it doesn't support the Palestinian right of return, which is a right that is guaranteed to all refugees under the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. You know, so this is supposed to be a principle that, you know, we were fighting in World War II, you know, to prevent happening in the future. So rather the denial of these rights to be ongoing in the future. And so the U.S. has played a critical role in preventing Palestinian refugees from being able to return to Israel, basically since post-67, when it became the main supporter of Israel. So that's a crucial thing. The other thing is just, I mean, you look on the international arena on a diplomatic level, the U.S. has basically been, you know, you talk about the U.N. Security Council resolutions. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, you could debate whether most people would say that, you know, whether the international institutions, even if, you know, the U.S. was supporting, say, resolutions saying settlements were illegal, whether any actual action would be done to prevent Israeli expansion of colonies, you know, in the occupied Palestinian territories. But what you can say is that the U.S. has been the only country that, even from a rhetorical level, has been so adamant in saying, you know, preventing, especially in recent years, it's gotten worse under every presidency, basically since Carter, preventing condemnation more proportional to, you know, the kind of violations of Palestinian rights that the Israeli government is visiting. And that includes, like, today, you know, you're talking about under the Trump administration, refusal to even consider an investigation of, you know, the Israeli massacre of peaceful protesters, you know, in the occupied Gaza Strip, where there's been a brutal blockade, you know, for the last over a decade now. I mean, just policies like that, it's just, you know, you wonder, like, what purpose that can possibly, you know, serve. It just almost comes across as sadistic, designed to crush the collective spirit of the Palestinians. And, you know, whether Israel would be able to get away with that without the support of the U.S., it's probably would be impossible, at least as on the scale that they're doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would just add that I think the Trump administration has allowed these things to, you know, just accelerate. There's already been a trend going back, like we said, you know, since at least, you know, 67, you know, at least since... there's been a consistent trend under several administrations, but things have accelerated a lot under Trump, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. We have the point where the U.S. ambassador to Israel, Friedman, is basically saying, like, yeah, annexation of the West Bank is, like, cool. Like, we support it. Whether that's, like, you know, the official U.S. line, it's like, oh, no, like, we can still say, oh, we support two-state. But, I mean, essentially, in practice, the Trump administration is doing everything moving the embassy to Jerusalem, kind of, you know, stating that, you know, Jerusalem is, like, you know, de facto capital of Israel, you know, defunding, you know, Palestinian aid. Really, you can't find, like, one sector where things haven't, like, accelerated, gotten much, much worse under Trump. But I think it's part of why we are thinking a lot about the importance of someone like Bernie and kind of changing that. But yeah, I mean, it doesn't look good right now under the Trump administration is the short answer.
And hopefully, you know, a Sanders administration, if that comes to pass, and DSA has endorsed Sanders, so we're fighting for that, and hopefully that would change things. But I think this goes, it's beyond, like, one singular politician. It's rooted in these structural phenomenon. It's and there's also this kind of ideological link between the United States and Israel, because Israel engages in what are called settler colonial practices, things that you mentioned, Danielle, the expulsion of Palestinian refugees, West Bank settlements, and the blockade of Gaza. And of course, if you have a non-propagandistic understanding of U.S. history, it's very clear that the United States was a settler colonial nation. This country was founded upon the genocide of the indigenous native population. The white people that live here in this country now did not live here 500 years ago. There was another group of people that had the land, had their own practices, and they were eliminated in war. So and Israel is founded upon these similar principles. And they're not the only two countries. You can root this in places like South Africa as well.
Canada, Australia,
most New Zealand. I mean, it was a deep practice of the British Empire, and then Israel, in a certain sense, is continuing that tradition. And in some ways, it's actually linked to the collapse of the British Empire. We don't have time to dive into that. But why is this like conception of settler colonialism so crucial for understanding the occupation, the direction of the Israeli state, and its relationship with the United States?
Well, I mean, I would just say, I mean, if you want to understand what the goals of the current Israeli government are, I mean, one thing is to know the history that, you know, it is a colonial society, and the history of the expulsion of the Palestinian refugees, the ongoing blockade in Gaza, the settlements in the West Bank, and so on. But, I mean, you can also just look at what Israeli officials say. I mean, they're very transparent. You know, the Netanyahu government campaigned on annexation of the West Bank.
Right.
You know, so there is a project of creating a greater Israel encompassing all of the historic Palestinian territories and even, I mean, also the Golan. And, I mean, who knows? I mean, if they're not going to stop there, who knows where it will end? But there's this basic project of creating a greater Israel that I don't know if Americans, how apprised they are of that. I think there is still a notion that lingers, especially more in, I think, the Jewish community, maybe, that has actually more, you know, of an education of this from a younger age, but that Israel is kind of a social democratic sort of society, humble kind of, you know, which there is a tradition of that within Israel, but I think it's that is not the other side of it, you know, the history of the settler colonialism and the ongoing, the changes that have actually Israeli society has undergone toward a more even far right from what it was, even in the, you know, 60s or 70s or in the earlier period. You can't understand where the current administration in Israel government is going without knowing about this greater Israel a project, you know. So from that level, if you want to know why all these atrocities are happening, you know, that it's key to coming at it from that angle.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think just that, you know, these are tactics that are used by a lot of countries. They're not unique, you know, the idea of, you know, setting up settlements or colonies, whatever you want to call them, that, you know, slowly expand to take more and more land. I mean, it's not a mystery. This is what our own country was founded this way. Lots
Manifest
of countries do that.
Manifest destiny.
So. Yeah. So I think that these are, I mean, in a way, these are almost normal things. You know, a lot of countries do that. The thing is, we can do something about it right now, right? Like, you know, we're basically funding it. We're allowing it to happen. So the difference is we can stop it, you know, and we have responsibility to. And yeah, I mean, I think actually a lot of it is, I think, rather simple. I mean, it just, countries want, you know, more resources. They want more, you know, control over, you know, labor. They want, if they can divide a population along ethnic lines, easier to control people. I mean, these are things that like every imperial power has done. So it informs what you know, how you understand the issue. But I think what you know, the real question is, okay, there's settler colonialism, what do you do about it? You know? And I think I think about the same thing with like when you're talking about like native rights in the US, right? Like, it's one thing to say, okay, the US is a settler colonial state, it's it's basically illegitimate. Okay, it might be, but we have the US here, so what are we going to do? Like, maybe we can support things like the Standing Rock protest or something like that. And that's kind of the approach that I think we have to take, is we know these practices are occurring. What can we do to end it? And there's specific campaigns like No Way to Treat a Child or something that are maybe our best steps forward.
Yeah, I think it's important to have the framework of analysis of settler colonialism to help understand like the specific structures within a state. But then obviously it's not this sort of like totality. There's contradictions within the settler colonial state. Like you're talking about, like there used to be this maybe somewhat social democratic tradition within Israel, but increasingly the settler colonial ideology has become more and more dominant as it reflects kind of the actual practices of the state. But that doesn't mean that there aren't ways, like here in the United States, yeah, we have this history of native genocide and slavery and all of these horrible things, but we also have in this country a tradition of organized resistance of right. like the labor movement, of the abolitionist movement, of the civil rights movement. I mean, I could get more and more extensively into this, but we don't have time to dive in that specifically.
Yeah.
But I think what a critical function of like settler colonial ideology and really like imperial ideology that you mentioned, Eric, is this kind of otherness, this like creating ethnic divisions mm-hmm. between people. And something that it's talked about as extreme, the opinion of people who support like BDS, when the opinion of most people that I know who support BDS is they want a single state that embraces democratic rights for every single person there. And it's and this is the position that is considered like violent and extremist and characterized as like creating this otherness, while people who support the ethno-nationalism that's inherent especially in Netanyahu's politics but in the settler colonial project are deemed as like rational thinkers who are not taking an extreme position. So it creates this kind of like absurd dichotomy. So like we want to dive in specifically to this legislation and campaign that you're talking about, mm-hmm. but I think it's important to talk about the BDS movement. Which is something that DSA has endorsed and which something that is brutally attacked and mischaracterized as like anti-Semitic, which is absurd. And like while diving into the BDS movement, like what are some concrete examples of current BDS efforts?
Well, I just think it's important to clarify what we mean by or I guess kind of what's commonly understood as the BDS movement from the 2005 call. So there's three primary demands, which is to end the occupation, guaranteeing a right of return, and equality for Palestinians living in Israel. So, I mean, I think, you know, the points about, you know, statehood questions, people might have those certain views, but in terms of what kind of BDS movement puts forward, those are the kind of the main demands. And it says, you know, the way to get there is through using, you know, nonviolent boycotts, divestments, and sanctions on Israel, you know, using them strategically and in line with international law. And that's kind of how it's written out. So some concrete things that we think are kind of good examples of this. One that we've been talking about a lot recently is Airbnb has been listing settlements as, you know, basically someone wants to go like stay in the West Bank, they can like stay in a settlement, right? And these settlements are like clearly illegal, right? So we're thinking, hey, this is an American company. We can boycott it. These are like, I mean, such a clear violation of international law. You know, basically colonies, right? So that's like a clear example of a company you can boycott, divest from. Maybe there's some other things you might want to mention.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of along those lines. There's actually a possibility for Palestinians and other, not just Palestinians, but basically any person that's a citizen of a foreign country or not a U.S. resident, to appeal in a U.S. court to war crimes that were carried out against them by U.S. Individuals. Mm-hmm. And so along those lines, there is another case. It's along the lines of the Airbnb court Eric was mentioning. It's called the Tamimi versus Adelson et al., I think something like that. Mm-hmm. So it involves the Bassem Tamimi, the father of Ahed, and some of his associates there, trying Sheldon Adelson in a U.S. court, basically broadly for genocide, but more specifically for their involvement in the settler enterprises, which are, I mean, you're talking about clearly illegal, recognized by virtually every country in the world, including the U.S., the settlements mm-hmm. as being illegal, at least the U.S. more in the past than now. So that's an example of something you can do, and there can potentially be avenues toward compensation and accountability for the likes of, you know, Sheldon Adelson and other Americans that are directly involved in the settler enterprises in the West Bank, including the ambassador we talked about, Friedman, earlier. Mm-hmm. So that's a thing folks can get involved with. They can at least, you know, that's an opportunity Palestinians have is to seek compensation in U.S. courts. There's other things you can do. Target specific companies, mm-hmm. Divest from companies like Caterpillar that make bulldozers, which are used to you know, demolish Palestinian homes in the West Bank. Companies like HP that make different hardware that's used, like, for example, checkpoints in the West Bank. Target companies that manufacture weapons that are mm-hmm. Used in airstrikes in Gaza, like Lockheed Martin.
Right.
You know, so these are examples of things we can do. Divestment, supporting those initiatives, judicial kind of avenues, in addition to the No Way to Treat a Child campaign that we we're going to talk about.
Yeah, I think we're about to transition. Do you have one last thought? I don't want to cut you off.
Well, I just think something Danielle and I have talked about is that I think in a BDS movement, I mean, the S is sanctions, and it's a really crucial part. You know, what can our government do to apply pressure to, you know, other foreign governments? And I think that No Way to Treat a Child is one of the most concrete examples of sanctions that we've seen. Not only concrete, but I think it's introduced in the House. I mean, like, just even the idea that sanctions on Israel is being introduced in the House and has co-sponsors is like a pretty huge thing. So
and we're about to talk about that right now. We're going to be joined by Shana Lowe. So you are listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. To connect with us after the show, you can email us at revolutionsnyc@gmail.com or sign up for our newsletter to get links to what we talk about on the show. You can do that on our website, revolutionsperminute.simplecast.com. You can also find us on Twitter at NYCRPM. Today, we're talking about justice in Palestine, and specifically the No Way to Treat a Child campaign. We've been talking more broadly about the issues between Israel and Palestine, how it relates to U.S. imperialism, but now we're going to dive in specifically to this No Way to Treat a Child campaign. And we are joined by Shana Lowe, who's from the Defense for Children International Palestine. And she's going to discuss the sort of work that she does there and that she's focused on and what that organization is. So, Shana, what can you tell us about the Defense for Children International Palestine?
First of all, thanks for having me on.
Thank you for coming on.
So Defense for Children International Palestine is a local Palestinian human rights organization based in Ramallah in the West Bank. We have field offices in Nablus and Hebron and also staff working in the Gaza Strip. We were established in 1991 to provide legal aid to Palestinian children who were being arrested and detained by Israeli forces and tried in their military courts. After a period of time, we recognized that we were hearing the same stories from these children and recognized that the violations that they were describing to our attorneys were widespread, systematic, and institutionalized. And so we expanded our mandate and began documenting violations against Palestinian children committed by Israeli forces, in addition to our work with children in prisons. We also document all child fatalities as a result of the crisis in Palestine-Israel, and also maimings and other injuries committed by Israeli forces and settlers. We also have a portion of our organization that focuses internally on children's rights in Palestine and engage with Palestinian elected officials, and not so many elected officials, but also Palestinian leadership to try and improve protections for children living there as well.
So what is happening in Israeli military prisons, and how is the United States directly complicit in the imprisonment of Palestinian children?
Yeah, so I'd like to just start by talking about what the experience that most Palestinian children who are arrested and detained by forces experience. So nearly 50% of the children who are arrested by Israeli forces are arrested in night arrests in their homes. So what that means is that typically the Israeli army will come, knock on their door, a number of soldiers in full military combat gear will enter a Palestinian home, bring together the whole family and arrest a child. I'm talking about children ranging in age from 12 to up to under 18 years old, so up to 17. These children the majority of these children are blindfolded. Their hands are bound, usually behind their backs with one zip tie. And then the children are put in the back of a military jeep, which is where the majority of the abuse that they face takes place. The children that we work with, close to 75% of them have reported that they experience physical violence. This includes beatings, kickings. Most of the kids are thrown on the floor of the military jeep and really taken on a rough ride. Their family doesn't know where they're going. A warrant is rarely presented. And these kids, for a period of hours, they're basically lost. Nobody knows where they are. Attorneys can't find them. They'll typically be taken to Israeli settlements, to police stations there, before they finally end up at one of the military prisons where they're subject to interrogation. The vast majority of these kids are charged with crimes such as throwing stones or Molotov cocktails. But despite whether or not they have committed these offenses, of course, there's nothing to justify the violation of their due process rights or to justify taking them from their homes in the middle of the night. The Convention on the Rights of the Child, of which Israel is a signatory, actually says that detention should be a last resort and that the best interests of the child should be considered. Obviously, pulling a terrified child out of their bed in the middle of the night is not taking into account the best interests of the child. From that moment on, the child knows that they no longer have a secure home and that even their parents can't protect them.
So how is the United States like directly complicit in this, and what have been efforts in the past to maybe not deal specifically with this, but from the U.S. to stop the more like harsher tactics that Israel is using, and why has that stopped, or now it's coming back? Sorry if that's too many questions at once.
Well, first of all, as Danielle and Eric spoke about in the first segment, our country, the United States, sends $3.8 billion in military aid to Israel. It's unclear exactly how that money is being spent, but we are pretty sure that it is that at least weapons and other materials that the U.S. provide are being used in these detentions, and also, of course, in terms of the other violations that we monitor, such as killings and maimings. So prior to the bill that we're going to talk about today, the piece of legislation, Betty McCollum actually introduced another bill in the 115th Congress, H.R. 4391, and that bill actually was a little different from the bill she's currently introduced, and that focused on a certification and reporting mechanism in which the U.S. State Department was to be required to certify that none of the U.S. military aid that was going to Israel was actually going towards the abuse of these children that are being arrested and tried in Israeli military courts. That bill managed to get 31 co-sponsors before the term expired. But in terms of efforts to prevent U.S. weapons and aid from being used to abuse children, there hasn't, unfortunately, been much work done by the U.S. government.
Considering our history, that unfortunately does not surprise me. So before diving into this new piece of legislation, and I think you've already summarized a lot of the work that, you know, Defense for Children International Palestine is doing, but like, what is the No Way to Treat a Child campaign, and what sort of work are you focused on?
Yeah, so the No Way to Treat a Child campaign is a joint project with the American Friends Service Committee, the Quakers, and Defense for Children International Palestine. And it's a campaign that really works to bring the human impact of the occupation both to the grassroots in the United States and also to policymakers to try and change U.S. policy by showing exactly the impact of Israeli military detention on children. And so this campaign was established about 4 years ago, and we've done a lot of work in terms of mobilizing grassroots support, institutional support from churches, community organizations, just like the DSA NYC, who are an endorser of the bill, And then also working to really engage policymakers in Washington, D.C. To make sure that they're aware of what's going on. We really see this work as a means of changing the discourse on Israel-Palestine and focusing more on a rights-based approach rather than one that's focused on political solutions.
Make it less about like these like ethnic nationalistic like antagonisms and more about like the actual people who are living there and suffering under those conditions. Is that a good way of framing it?
Yeah, I think when you go to Washington, D.C. and meet with members of Congress, they want to reaffirm their support for a two-state solution. And that's kind of where the conversation was ending. You know, I support a two-state solution, a state for Palestinians and a state for Israelis. And that's fine, but we want to make sure that there's actually work that's being done to change what's happening on a day-to-day basis. And so the political solution will happen in the future, but for now what we want to focus on is how we can improve the lives of people living in the region and make sure to stop human rights violations, specifically in our work against children, but also generally.
And so the first group of co-sponsors of H.R. 2407 was made public today. Yvette Clark, a House representative from New York's 9th District, which is pretty close to where this radio station is located, signed on today due to the campaign work, or at least I'm told largely due to the campaign work of NYC DSA organizers. So what is H.R. 2407? Why is it such a transformative bill? And how does today's news show the importance of using direct action to pressure politicians?
Yeah, so H.R. 2407 is the Promoting Human Rights for Palestinian Children Living Under Israeli Military Occupation Act. As I mentioned earlier, Congresswoman Betty McCollum is the lead sponsor of this bill. This is the second bill that she has introduced in Congress promoting Palestinian children's rights. It's important to note that this is a bill of general applicability, so it doesn't merely apply, it would not merely apply to Israel, but would apply to any country in which the U.S. provides foreign aid, foreign military aid. And so what this bill seeks to do is it's an amendment of the Leahy laws, which forbid or prohibit U.S. tax dollars to be given to foreign forces who where there's credible evidence that they commit gross violations of human rights. And so this bill, while it's contextualized around Palestine, seeks to prevent U.S. tax dollars from going towards any foreign forces who receive military aid that abuse and detain children. The bill also, in addition to that, allows for the allocation of $19 million, which would be allocated to human rights defenders and organizations that are monitoring the situation on the ground, and also go towards psychosocial and rehabilitative treatment for Palestinian children who have been subject to Israeli military detention. The transformative thing about this bill is that, as I mentioned earlier, it refocuses this conversation and centers it on human rights and justice. And this is part of a shift that we're trying to make in Congress, where instead of focusing on political solutions, people are focusing on the human rights situation on the ground and the human impact that occupation has on Palestinians.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that great answer. I think you really described the bill in detail, and now I understand the importance of it. It seems like it's really transformative to even just get this out there. I mean, you can't even talk in some circles in this country about like what's really happening on the ground in Palestine. You have these efforts to basically criminalize protests. So to see the organizing that's gone into getting this in Congress and to see now there's momentum behind it is very encouraging. So you're listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. To connect with us after the show, you can email us at revolutionsnyc@gmail.com or sign up for our newsletter to get links to what we talk about on the show. You can do that on our website, revolutionsperminute.simplecast.com. You can also find us on Twitter at NYCRPM. Today, we're talking about justice in Palestine, and specifically the No Way to Treat a Child campaign, as well as the legislations that has emerged from this struggle, H.R. 2407. We're about to open up our phone line, so we have like 10 minutes left. So at this time, we want to hear from you. Call in, talk about the subject, if you want to talk about what's going on in Palestine, if you have any comments about U.S. imperialism in general, we'd love to hear from you. You can call us at 212-209-2877. That's 212-209-2877. So while we're waiting for callers, is there any specific, you know, actions, events, is there a way to get in touch with the work that you all are doing?
Yeah, so I can speak to DSA, some of our organizing on behalf of the bill. The No Way to Treat a Child campaign is basically the main focus of the anti-war working group. Folks that are interested in getting more New York members of Congress to sign on to the bill, which there are none except for Yvette Clark. And we have, I mean, I believe there's 12 other representatives in the New York City sort of area. If folks are interested in getting involved in some of our other advocacy to get them to support the bill, they can attend our next Palestine committee meeting that is going to be this Wednesday at 6 p.m. In Manhattan at the Think Coffee on 8th Street or 8th Avenue and 14th Street. And they can also attend on the 22nd of June, which I believe is a Saturday. Mm-hmm. We are going to be petitioning on behalf of the No Way to Treat a Child legislation at the Smorgasbord Fair in Williamsburg in Brooklyn at 1 p.m.
And Shana, before we get to your information, I definitely want to have people be able to connect with you and your organization. We have a caller live. Hey, caller, you're live on Revolutions Per Minute. What's your question? What's your comment?
Yes, hello, RPM. I heard somebody once say, I have two things to point out. I once heard somebody say that this government in Israel now, it used to be like called the secular Zionist government, and then they call it the democratic government, a democracy. But what people don't realize is that this is an ongoing process, and it ultimately culminates in what could be referred to as the Jewish theocratic kingdom of Israel. And anybody who stands in the way or is disturbed by this is going to be more and more disturbed, because there is no God but the God of Israel. He gathers in his people, and he actually laughs in your faces. That's all I really wanted to say.
I think there. Thank you very much for your call. I think there definitely is a really disturbing trend of ethno-nationalism, and it's in Israel. I mean, it's always been there. Zionism is inherently an ethno-nationalist ideology, but it's become increasingly militant, increasingly violent, increasingly organized around occupying and expanding its territory. And I think there are some theocratic lines you can draw there, but I think it's much more important to think of this in terms of imperialism and capitalism, that this is about the expansion of this sort of Western white supremacist ideology, that Israel is an extension of what's been going on for centuries, which is the expansion of capital and the expansion of empire as a form of dominating the world and centralizing and concentrating wealth and power in the hands of a few people and state entities. And Israel, in many ways, is a client state of the U.S., which is, as I would imagine most people listening to the show know, the most powerful imperial force in world history. Do we have another caller live? Yeah. Hey, caller, you're live on RPM. What's your question? What's your comment?
Hello.
Hey, how's it going?
What I would like to say is that I agree with practically everything that you say, except for one thing. The strategy ends up being essentially begging the ruling class, begging the capitalist class to please be nicer. And as far as the United States is concerned, that means begging them not to be as imperialist as they are. Because, as I've said before, because I've talked to your guest last night, it is a matter of the United States is the imperial power, and when Israel does something, it's really the United States doing something. So if we need to boycott something, we need to boycott the United States. And that might sound absurd, but it's actually the reality of the situation. Now, as a matter of propaganda, I do not mind the BDS movement, but it really does amount to begging the imperialists not to be imperialists.
Well, thank you very much for your call. I think there are real strategic questions that we have to deal with here. I don't know if any of the three of you would like to respond to that in particular.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say, you know, our legislative strategy, first of all, the question is, you know, given, you know, and this is also in response to what the last caller said, given that, you know, the U.S., Israel is a client state of the U.S., the question is always, what can we do about it, right? And I think with regard to the No Way to Treat a Child strategy, supporting the campaign and the legislation, the strategy is not simply to go to legislators and say, hey, please, you know, embrace the bill. You know, that's not the only thing we're doing. You know, part of it is also about building, and I mentioned it earlier with regard to the Yemen campaign. It's not only the Palestine campaign we're working on. You know, we're trying to work with community organizations in the Palestinian and Arab American community, the broader anti-war community, to build a broad-based movement that's going to end, you know, U.S. support for humanitarian violations and regimes visiting war crimes, and even in some cases the U.S., you know, directly visiting war crimes abroad. You know, and that's part of what we're doing. So working with community organizations, it also involves, you know, changing the kind of conversation around these things in public. We alluded to it earlier. A lot of people don't understand, you know, actual policies Israel's carrying on. They have this vague notion of it as a, you know, democratic society, broadly benevolent, you know, force in the region. They don't understand, you know, the kind of murdering children on a beach that are playing hide and seek or soccer, you know, or torturing children in military prisons, which has been going on, you know, as Shana talked about, on a systematic basis, really, I mean, for decades, ever since it's been even documented, since the late 90s or early 90s, and probably even before, you know, as far as we know. So, I mean, doing legislative advocacy is part of a broader strategy, you know, that I think we as folks trying to build not just an anti-war movement, but also, you know, a movement to build a more decent, you know, U.S. society writ large. You know, I think that it's something that we need to embrace in DSA, and I mean, just as Americans, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's viewed as a tactic in like a much broader strategy. I don't think anyone here is under the impression that we can like end U.S. imperialism and capitalism by like asking our legislators to do that. This is a one tactic of consciousness raising, of specifically making material gain for people to stop funding of this like specific act. And if there can be, you know, gains made in that way that can help build power for the anti-war movement, the anti-imperialist movement in general. But it's right. This is one means in a broader strategy, is my understanding. We have one more caller live. All right, we got one last caller. Hey, you're live on Revolutions Per Minute. What's your comment? What's your question?
Hey, how's it going? My question is to you guys, why do you think all efforts to rectify or fix a situation like Palestine and the Middle East is always shot down so quickly and considered like anti-Semitic? Like any comment or anything pretty much always just gets shot down to anti-Semitism. Why do you think that is? Like what kind of pull do you think Israel has to make it seem like any kind of efforts usually get shot down and just boiled down to anti-Semitism.
I mean, I have a lot of responses to this, but I don't know if any of three of you would like to say anything.
No, I mean, yeah, I mean, just, you know, I think that there's, look, people have, you know, good intentions behind it, right? I mean, there's an actual record of things like, you know, the Holocaust, you know, the pogroms, you know, in Russia, which I think people are vaguely aware of at some level, you know, in U.S. society. And so it comes from, you know, a good place, right? Like, we don't want to repeat these things happening again. But I mean, I think if we look at, you know, actual actions which were supposed to have been taken in the wake of World War II, you know, like passing the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the Nuremberg, you know, trials, the Nuremberg principles that grew out of that, we're supposed to be trying to prevent these war crimes from happening in the future, you know, and Israel, as we mentioned earlier, it was a society, you know, that grew out of, you know, the colonial period, basically, in Western history. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of its history was colored with these kind of violations. And if we're, you know, have consistent positions, we have to address that.
Yeah, I want to add to this is that, yeah, anti-Semitism is a real thing. And it's something that the left struggles against and fights against. But supporting the people in this country that are supporting BDS are on the left. And the anti-Semitism in this country is rooted on the far right. And the people who are the strongest and most vocal supporters of Israel are Christian evangelicals, and as well as some elements of the American fascist movement. They want Jews out of this country, boxed off somewhere else, or they want to bring about their apocalyptic visions. That's the evangelical notion of Israel. So there's a lot more anti-Semitism on the pro-Israel side than on the anti-Zionist movement. And we just have to wrap up, but I lastly just want to give Shana the chance to give people the chance to connect with DCI.
Yeah, so I just want to, if I can, add one additional comment to the last question, which is a conflation of Zionism with Judaism, and then that's been a successful campaign. Finally, if people want to learn more about DCI and the No Way to Treat a Child campaign, I encourage you to visit our websites. All of our information and documentation is there, as well as on the No Way to Treat a Child campaign, where there are lots of resources on how to organize in your own community.
And that's it for us. Thank you so much for joining us today, everybody. And we'll be back next week talking about more green energy and climate change policy. You've been listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI. Thank you very much.